Chapter 17. Rudolf Isfording never gave much thought to the people whose money he laundered. He'd insulated himself from his clients so they were nothing more than passcodes on bank account ledgers or vague signatures on legal documents. He had always considered himself a numbers man, a person most comfortable behind a desk protected by a paper fortress. Now the evidence of what he'd done was sprayed across the walls of the office and pooled under Ludmilla's body. He couldn't bring himself to look at the carnage that had been Yuri Zaitsev's chest. Rafik had been called out to the warehouse before asking the lawyer any questions. Mohammed watched him from the office doorway, his eyes looking like chips of obsidian. Isfording could see that the Palestinians were maneuvering a ramp to the back of the trailer to unload the armored van. The Russians who'd snatched him had taken great pains to make sure no one had been injured or killed. He felt certain that Rafik and his thugs wouldn't be so scrupulous. Isfording's entire body trembled like he was in the grip of an epileptic seizure. The terrorist leader called out for Mohammed to join him for a moment. He pinned his forwarding with a menacing glare and stepped out onto the warehouse floor. Minutes crawled by, allowing the lawyer's fears to kaleidoscope in ever more horrifying thoughts, so when the sound penetrated his mind, he wasn't sure what he heard. It sounded like someone was calling his name, but the voice was distorted and wheezy, like they were a great distance away or it was coming from a dream. He turned his eyes toward the doorway. No one was there. He looked around the room. Ludmilla lay face up, her clothes sodden with blood.
Isfording.
He heard it again, and had he not been turning his head to check on Zaitsev, he never would have believed the Russian's lips had moved. By some miracle, Zaitsev was still alive. He was ghostly white, and blood continued to drool down his chest like crimson molasses. Isfording felt hope surge inside him like a dose of adrenaline.
"Keep them talking," Zaitsev mumbled, his eyes flickering from shock.
"What?" the lawyer whispered urgently. Mohammed or Rafik could be back any second.
"Tell them anything they ask. Just keep them talking."
Zaitsev's voice was so faint, Isfording had to cup a hand to his ear and tilt his head to hear him.
"I don't understand," he pleaded. "More of my men are on the way."
Zaitsev's voice trailed off. His eyelids fluttered and rolled back into his skull as he fell unconscious once again. How he had survived the multiple gunshots staggered the imagination. Rudolf Isfording recalled what the Russian had said prior to the attack, that they were waiting for more of his companions. No doubt they would be armed. His first rush of hope became a torrent. He was going to be rescued. He was going to get out of this alive. A bellow of exhaust echoed from the warehouse, and the armored van slowly emerged from the trailer, guided by one of the masked terrorists. Rafik strode back into the office an instant later. His face was contorted in a cruel mix of hatred and self-satisfaction. He dragged a chair from behind one of the desks and sat astride it in front of his forwarding. His breath smelled of carrion.
"Now, pig, you will tell me what you did with the money you stole from my people."
He spoke in English, his accent somehow making him even more intimidating.
"I will tell you what you want to know," Isfording replied in Arabic.
Rafik slapped him across the face hard enough to leave a red print on his skin.
"You will not defile the language of the Prophet again. Speak English, Isfording."
"Isfording?
That is a Jewish name."
"I'm Catholic." Rafik slapped him again, his eyes going wide with insane rage.
"You will speak only when asked a question."
Isfording glanced to the motionless form of Yuri Zaitsev, praying that his men would come soon.
"We know you used part of my people's money to create fake companies," Rafik began.
One is called D Commercial Advisors. Another is Equity Partners International. You used these companies to buy a large ship called Mouse that is someplace in the Far East. You will tell me who controls these companies and who profits while my people suffer. For a long second, Isfording didn't know what to say. The Palestinian had it all wrong. None of the PLO money he'd hidden away had gone into that deal. That one was set up solely for Anton Savage and the Sikh, Sher Singh. Then he thought that it didn't matter if he told Rafiq all about it. Zaitsev's men would be here any moment, and the kidnappers would be dead.
That is correct, he said in a scratchy voice before clearing his throat. There were actually two ships, floating dry docks. One called Mouse, the other Suri.
Who has control of these vessels? Rafiq demanded.
A Russian named Anton Savage and a Sikh named Sher Singh.
You are wise not to lie. There was little praise in Rafiq's voice. We know about Savage. Tell me where we can find him.
I do not know, Isfording admitted miserably. He travels all the time. I don't think he has a home, only a postbox in St. Petersburg.
Rafiq made to strike the lawyer again.
It is true, I swear, Isfording cried. I have only met him once, over 2 years ago.
We will return to him in a moment. What about this Sikh? Who is he?
Sher Singh. He is Pakistani, but now lives in Indonesia. He is a wealthy man. His holdings are vast. Timber, shipping, real estate. The largest company is the Karamita Breakers Yard on the west coast of Sumatra. I believe he controls the two dry docks through it.
Have you ever met this man? What does he look like?
I've met him through a video conference last year. He appears to be a big man, and like all Sikhs, has a long beard and wears a turban.
Mohammed suddenly burst into the office, jabbering in almost incoherent Arabic.
Rafiq, the police arrest Fodl. He knows
He drew silent. Location, Rafiq snarled in his native tongue. Fodl knows our location. The terrorist got to his feet. Isfording gave a startled cry and cowered into the couch cushions, expecting to be beaten.
Please, don't hurt me. Please.
Silence, Rafiq snapped. He took a blindfold and a pair of hard plastic ear protectors from Mohammed.
What are you doing?
Isfording sniveled. Tears coursed down his cheeks. They were going to execute him right here and now.
I said silence, Rafiq roared.
Before Rafiq tied the blindfold around Isfording's head, Mohammed jammed soft rubber plugs deep into his ears. Then came the blindfold and finally the ear protectors. Isfording couldn't stop shaking. He could neither see nor hear anything. He was then gagged, but surprisingly not too tightly. One of the terrorists hauled him to his feet, and together they guided him from the office. He had no idea what was happening, couldn't tell where they were taking him. After just a few steps, he smelled the exhaust from the idling van. A moment later, he was unceremoniously dumped into the back. Though disoriented, he could sense the presence of the three guards charged with driving him to his court date. His ankles were bound with some kind of plastic tie, while his wrists and hands were taped as tightly as a mummy's wrappings. He couldn't wiggle a single finger, which meant he'd be unable to worry the tape off his hands. Rafiq's men were as efficient as they were deadly. Isfording imagined the guards had been similarly bound. The doors slammed shut as soon as he was secure and the van took off, but they went only a short distance. Judging by how he and the guards rolled across the floor, they'd made three tight turns. As near as he could tell, the Palestinians had merely stashed the van behind the warehouse. The driver killed the ignition. A few minutes passed before Isfording felt the driver slam his door. He and the guards were isolated from each other by the gags and ties, unable to hear because of the ear protectors. He could not imagine a worse feeling of deprivation, and while he was alive for the moment, he had no idea how long it would be before the van started up again and the four of them were taken away and killed. Cabrillo had slammed the armored van's door hard enough for the men inside to feel it, then tossed the keys onto the roof. He checked the street fronting the warehouse one more time. No one had seen him hide the vehicle behind the building. He twirled the spray bottle of bleach around his finger as he walked. Certain that no one had left behind fingerprints, he'd taken the precaution of dousing the inside of the cab with bleach to dilute any trace DNA. Link greeted him at the door. The ex-SEAL had unwound the keffiyeh he'd worn to hide his black face and let the checkered headcloth drape around his wide shoulders. Artificial blood from when Julia had shot him dripped from the fringed edges. "Well done," Juan said, and the two men exchanged toothy grins. "You must have a thing for playing Arab bad guys, Chairman," the big man teased. "First you were Colonel Harani of the Syrian army. Today you're Palestinian terrorist leader Rafik. Who are you going to be tomorrow, Ali Baba?"
"Only if you play Scheherazade and do the Dance of the Seven Veils."
Mike Trono, who'd taken over the role of Yuri Zaitsev for Rudy Isfording's benefit, was plucking the spent remains of devices called squibs from a special vest he wore under his shirt. The squibs were made of tiny explosive charges and an ounce or two of fake blood. These devices had been a staple of Hollywood effects wizards for years. A more sophisticated device had been placed inside Link's headscarf to make it appear that Julia had shot away half his skull. The office had also been rigged with small charges along the walls and on the furniture to further the illusion of bullets striking the plasterboard and metal. Of course, all the weapons they'd used to stage the assault had fired blanks. When Isfording and the guards were found, the story they would tell would be too bizarre to be anything other than the truth. After being grabbed by the Russian mob, the lawyer's rescuers had then been attacked by rogue members of the PLO looking for money missing since Arafat's death. The attack had been savage and none of the Russians survived. Then the terrorists ran off when they learned one of their men might have been picked up by the police. What couldn't be so easily explained is what happened to the Russians' bodies and why the terrorists hadn't taken Isfording with them. Nor would they be able to trace how the Palestinians got into the country in the first place. Juan wasn't too concerned with those details. The Swiss authorities would rattle their sabers about tighter border restrictions, but in the end they'd be satisfied because no civilians had been hurt throughout the ordeal. They had their star witness back in custody, and the world was minus a few gangsters from St. Petersburg. And as a bonus, he thought that they would probably put pressure on Isfording to explain where the former head of the PLO had stashed the billions he'd stolen from his people. Who knew? Maybe they'd even get some of it back. The one thing he couldn't control was if the lawyer revealed what he'd said under interrogation. He didn't want the Swiss looking into Anton Savage, whoever he was, or a Sikh shipping mogul named Sher Singh. He could only hope that the lawyer was as frightened of Savage as he was of the PLO and would keep silent. Huxley stepped out of the warehouse's only lavatory. She'd washed away the fake blood from her face. She'd also stripped down to a black tank top that barely contained her curves to clean the mess away from her arm. The squib that had made it appear her arm had been blown nearly off had left a livid purple bruise on her otherwise flawless white skin.
"Are you okay, Ludmilla?"
"Da,"
Julia deadpanned, rubbing the spot.
"Is nothing."
Then she arched a teasing eyebrow.
"Why is it everyone but you and Holly look like extras from some zombie B-movie?"
"Because none of you either speak Arabic or look Arabic," he laughed.
Although Halley's portrayal of the steely-eyed terrorist Muhammad left a lot to be desired, he had just a couple of lines to learn, and he managed to mangle both. On a brighter note, I have to hand it to Kevin and his team in the magic shop. They really outdid themselves this time, especially Link's effect. For a second, I thought it had gone wrong, and his head really did explode.
Scared me too, Julia admitted.
Juan called out to gather the rest of the team. Okay, everyone, listen up. First off, I want to commend each and every one of you on a job well done. This little caper was a long shot from the beginning, and you pulled it off flawlessly.
That mean we're getting bonuses? Halley asked.
You most of all, Halley. I'm sending you to a Berlitz so you can at least fake speaking Arabic. This earned a round of good-natured laughter at Kasim's expense. Julia, head back to your hotel as soon as you're ready. You've made your flight reservations?
I'll be in Istanbul by 2 o'clock.
From there, I can hook up with you anywhere.
Judging by what Isfordin said, I take it we're going to Indonesia?
Cabrillo nodded. Sher Singh sounds like the next link in the chain.
As soon as I reach Ataturk International, I'll book a flight to Jakarta.
She slipped into a dark blouse. All of my disguise stuff is in a suitcase in the office.
I'll make sure it's burned, Juan assured her and gave her a kiss on the cheek. Julia waved goodbye to the others and settled into her rental car. Link opened the garage door and she roared out of the warehouse.
Okay then. I've wiped down the armored van for prints and hit the cab and door handles with bleach. Even though we're torching this building, make sure you go over everywhere you've been, especially the bathroom. Not that any of our DNA is at Interpol, but I don't want to take any chances. You all have your escape routes planned. Stay loose, and we'll all be on the Oregon by this time tomorrow.
Although he'd used disguises each time he'd made most of the rental arrangements, Cabrillo was the most likely to be identified, so he would be the next to get out of the country. While the others cleaned up the warehouse, he changed clothes and used a bucket of water and a rag to wash the concrete dust from his Mercedes SUV. By the time he finished, Halley, Link, and Trono had finished scrubbing down the warehouse and placing incendiary bombs throughout the structure.
How long should I set the timer? Link asked.
Hold on.
Juan used his cell phone to call the Oregon.
Law offices of Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe, Linda Ross greeted in her high-pitched voice.
Cabrillo calculated the time difference between Switzerland and the South China Sea.
Good evening, Linda.
Chairman, how'd it go?
Smooth as silk. Listen, have Murph and Eric been monitoring the news here in Zurich?
Sure have. Let me get them.
Mark Murphy came on the line a moment later. Juan could hear the speed metal music blaring from the headphones Murph had pulled down around his neck. It sounded like someone using a chainsaw against a piece of railroad track.
German, from what I'm getting from CNN and Sky News, the Swiss don't have a clue what happened. At first they thought it was a structural failure of some kind, and then they thought they were having their own 9/11. From what I can get from the local police chatter, there's been a couple mentions about the missing armored car and unknown gunman at the scene when the explosions went off.
Are they closing borders or delaying flights?
No. They think this is a local thing.
So we're safe for the time being.
It'll take them so long to add 2 and 2, they'll need to include interest.
Huh?
It's a joke. You know, Swiss banks. Interest? Hey, that was funny.
Stick to being a connoisseur of fine music and leave the humor to the professionals, like Max.
How far are you from Sumatra?
A few days still. Why?
Rudolf Isfordin said the guy who controls the mouse is named Sher Singh. He owns a company called the Karameda Breakers Yard. Check them both out. Also, track down another floating dry dock called the Suri. Singh owns it, too.
How do you spell that?
Juan did and added, it's French for mouse.
Got it.
Thanks, Murph. Tell Max I want you to break off from the mouse and make best practical speed for the Karameda Yard. Best practical speed was far slower than the Oregon's top speed, but running that fast during daylight hours or without radar jamming would give away one of the ship's most important secrets. I'll pass it along. See you in a day or so. Juan killed the connection and turned to Link and the others awaiting orders.
It seems the police don't know what happened, so we're in the clear for now. We'll all be out of Switzerland within 6 hours, so set the charge for 8 p.m.
Isfording and the guards are in for an uncomfortable day, but they won't dehydrate by the time the local fire department arrives and discovers the missing armored car. Cabrillo fired up the SUV's throaty V8. He had a long drive to Munich ahead of him, where he'd catch his own flight out of Europe. He hoped that by the time he got there, the adrenaline still pumping through his body would dissipate, because his hands remained shaky and his stomach was still knotted. He also hoped that Mark would find that the Mouse's sister ship was operated as a legitimate dry dock and not involved in hijacking on the open seas. But he knew the chances of that were longer than Hali Kasim giving the keynote sermon at next year's Hajj to Mecca.